Okay, so we're talking about membranes. We're talking about the specialized serous membranes that lines inside of cavities and organs themselves. But there's a couple of other membranes that we do find in the body, and each of these have sort of their own responsibilities, and we find them in certain areas. So, of course, the one is that you're quite involved in when we have cold and so forth are known as mucous membranes, and of course, the point of these is to create mucus. So mucous membranes can also be known as the mucosa. And of course, it lines a body cavity that opens directly to the external environment, for example, the mouth, anal canal, urethra, or vagina. So the idea is that the mucus is a protective mechanism. So the reason why you have mucus in your nose is so that anything can kind of get captured in that mucus, which you can then sneeze out or blow out to catch with it. It's the same as any other vulnerable opening from the outside world into the body. There's mucus there, partly as protection, but in some cases also acts as a lubricant. So you do have mucous membranes sort of in the alimentary canal or where you're digesting food, because this mucus does act as a bit of a lubricant with the foods that you're eating to kind of slide them through the alimentary tract. It has an apical lining of the epithelium and an underlying layer of connective tissue. So it's sort of specialized on top of the epithelium. And we're going to learn that an epithelial layer plays an important role in defense against microbial or pathogenic invasions. So in this class, we will be talking about tissues. One of them, of course, will be the epithelial tissue. So epithelial tissue has its own modifications as protection, because epithelial tissues are tissues that line. So your actual skin that you're looking at is epithelial tissue. And its architecture is created in such a way that it helps protect us from the outside world. It's, as we all know, if you get a cut, you're far easier to get an infection than if your skin's intact, right? Well, epithelial tissue lines anything else, again, such as the respiratory tract and the digestive system, because, again, it's an entrance way in. And as we know, with certain bugs like Norwalk, that can result in getting into our digestive system and causing, immeasurable problems, vomiting and diarrhea and all those sorts of things. And because it's modified, the bacteria or virus has modified itself to pass through that tissue to get to where it needs to get to. As previously reviewed, the cells are tightly connected together by tight junctions. I shouldn't have that in there because I changed it a bit, but I used to give this afterwards, but that's okay. Just understand that in epithelial tissue, because again, think of your skin as being a little bit waterproof, how does that happen? The cells actually are very connected together. There's actually some specialized areas where cells are, shall we say, for lack of a better term, glued together, which keeps the integrity much more, keeps them waterproof and all those sorts of things. And we will get into those a bit later. This layer also contains goblet cells, which secrete mucus, which maintains moisture, which prevents the tissue from drying out, also plays a role of lubrication, which allows food to move through, and also acts as a trap for particles such as in the nose. So you have these specialized goblet cells, and their whole role is to create this mucus and then secretes it out. And how much can these secrete, especially in the early days of a head cold? You can blow it on almost an entire Kleenex box in an afternoon, right? When they're really irritated and inflamed and they're producing vast amounts of mucus, you can actually produce quite a bit. There are different types of epithelial tissue which can be found in various areas of the body, and we will be discussing those a little bit later on. So we can see here in the gut, right, we've got the mucosa here. So here is our muscular layer of the stomach itself. Then we have a layer where we find the blood vessels, and then sort of the workings, shall we say, of the stomach, because, its whole role is to grind down food and secrete enzymes to break down fats, proteins, or carbohydrates, right? That's the whole purpose. This is sort of the mucosal layer is where all that happens. So you see you have these gastric glands, and then you have these gastric pits. And what happens is, of course, the stomach secretes very, very acidic material, which helps break down food. In fact, the pH and acidity of the stomach, if you took it and just kind of got it clean by itself, you could dissolve steel with it. It's quite powerful. It's pretty powerful stuff. We don't have amounts of it. But if anybody takes, the pills you can take, Prevacid, see on TV for heartburn, that kind of stuff. The medications in those pills slow down the production of the secretion of those acids that we use. To the point where if someone's on a prescriptive level of those medications and they take them for a long period of time, they'll actually get osteoporosis because they lower the acidic environment in the stomach so low, you can't absorb calcium. You need that acidity to help absorb calcium. Yeah, so they discovered, because I used to have a stomach problem and I used to take those pills and they discovered that, men would show up in their 30s with osteoporosis and they'd be like, what the hell? And it was because they weren't able to absorb calcium properly because of these medications. Always remember that. Medications do great things and help people a lot, but there's a price to pay for most of them, which we know is a side effects. And as you know, when you watch those commercials on American television, it does everything but keep you alive when you read it, right? Every medication has side effects to some degree. It speaks to, when we get to homeostasis, talk about homeostasis, it speaks to just how efficient this organism is and how it's able to do all the things it does quite nicely on its own without drugs. You also have within this, you have this connective tissue that's in here. It's areolar, which means it has kind of lots of spaces in it, and it's known as the lamina propria, which means one's own. And this lamina propria supports the epithelial layer and binds it all together. So we're going to discover when we start looking at tissues and organs and so forth, there is deliberateness of binding layers of cells together to form tissues and so forth. And understandably so, because there's a lot of trauma that goes on, even when, if you were to, well, you'll hear it, right? At night after a big meal, that gurgling and stuff that goes on in your belly, it's because things are ripping around. Your stomach deliberately, literally squeezes, twists, turns, breaking food down. It does that deliberately to, to squish around and get that acid that it produces as much as possible to break that food down. When do you start breaking down food? Yeah. Everybody here done the cornstarch or the potato test? Yeah, take a raw potato, cut a small cube, and chew it. Anybody here tried raw potato? It's pretty disgusting, right? Keep chewing it. Keep chewing it. It'll turn sweeter than candy. Because the enzymes in your mouth will break down the complex carbohydrates and break them into simple sugars, and that potato will actually become sweet. Hence the reason why cooking makes things like onions very sweet, because it breaks down the complex carbohydrates and makes them more simple, therefore you get that sweet hit from them. This lamina propria does provide flexibility and protection, also holds the blood vessels. Because of that, it allows for movement of some nutrients and oxygen, which helps support the metabolism of epithelial cells. You'll hear me say that a lot, that they're supporting the metabolic needs of a tissue or a cell. What we mean by that is any nutrient, like a vitamin or a mineral or oxygen itself, a cell requires in order to stay alive and function to meet its metabolic needs, breaking down and building up of compounds within the cell itself. So when we talk about blood in the area, it's meeting the needs of the tissue. Now, there are areas of the body in certain tissues where there is no blood supply. And how do those cells get what they need for metabolism? And that's through something we'll probably get to a bit today, things like diffusion, osmosis, all that kind of stuff. That's how they tend to move around. You can see here, then we've got the myenteric plexus out here, and we have the submucosal area, and then we have the exposed, what's called the lumen. For example, this is intestinal tract where the foods travel through this space here, and all this works together to maintain integrity, secrete enzymes, mucus to have food travel through quite nicely, and of course absorption of whatever gets broken down for the body to use generally elsewhere. Sorry, yeah. That's a cutaway of, like, say the small intestine. So you tend to have, you have an epithelial layer, you have a muscular layer, and so forth. It's moving things around, right? Everybody's heard the term peristalsis, correct? Okay, so this is a rhythmic contraction that the gut uses. Because think about it, what happens? You eat solid food, right? You swallow it, and then through lots of processes, you have a bowel movement, and you take the solids that you chewed on, apple, banana, steak, whatever it was, everything that the body requires from it, pulled out, and what's left over is what you defecate out because you don't need it any longer. There's, you've gotten what you need out of it. How does it get from your mouth down to your bum? Peristaltic contractions rhythmically push all that material through the small intestine, where lots of absorption occurs, into the large intestine, where water gets removed, and eventually you defecate out what remains, as far as that goes. The walls of the ventral cavity and the outer surface of the visceral organs, of course, are covered by this thin double-layered serous membrane, or serosa, and the part of the membrane that lines the cavities is the parietal, and eventually folds in on itself to form the visceral, as we know, that covers the organs themselves. And, of course, we know that we have this serous fluid. I don't know why that's there. I guess I just threw it up here. I think it was probably doing it because it was in a different place. We've already done that. We've already done the folds. Mesentery we've done. Now, the next is called the cutaneous membrane, and this is basically your skin. So you're surrounded by a membrane. It used to be the old, in the original Trivial Pursuit game, that used to be the question, what is the largest organ in the human body? Skin. And it is an organ. It does a lot of things. So the cutaneous membrane is known as the skin. Of course, it covers your entire external surface. It has an apical layer of what you're looking at when you look at your skin. That is known as the epidermis. And then, of course, deep to the epidermis, we find the dermis. So the epidermis, we're going to discover there's no blood supply there, generally. So, you know, when you scrape yourself, you don't bleed. You know, remember the little boys in grade school used to stick pins through their hands to freak you out and there'd be no blood or whatever because they're, what's that? Yeah, so, you know, there's no blood because you remained in the epidermal layer. If you were to go down into the dermal layer, of course, that's where the blood supply is and you would get blood if you got too deep. This epidermal layer consists of something called keratinized stratified squamous epithelium, and that is a very specialized epithelium that can take trauma. So even using a towel to dry yourself is traumatic to skin. If you were to take that towel and dry yourself to the layer of tissue that lines the inside of your cheek, you would tear it. But you don't do it with the skin, because this specialization, it's much tougher. It's made this way to be tough because it is exposed to the outside world. The dermis below consists of dense irregular connective tissue and areolar connective tissue. And of course, this is where we find all the nerves and blood supply and so on and so forth. And we will be looking at the integumentary system as we move along. So we can kind of see it here. Here's the epidermis here at the top with this living dermis lying down below underneath. And that sort of represents a membrane because it surrounds our whole body. The next one is called the synovial membrane. We'll be talking a lot more about that in Clinical Anatomy 1. And it sort of represents these synovial joints in terms of specialization. But this membrane produces the fluid that goes in a joint that makes it slippery, so that when the bones move together in the joint, they're nice and slippery and they move against each other and there's no friction, shall we say, between the bony two bones that come together to form the joint, and it just allows that movement without a problem. And when you look at the synovial fluid, it looks just like a white of an egg that hasn't been cooked. So it's clear, somewhat viscous, slippery. If you've ever had raw egg white on your finger and you haven't washed it off, there's a slipperiness to it, yes, that when you initially feel it. This membrane does not open to the external environment, and there is no epithelial layer. This is just a type of tissue that secretes the synovial fluid into these joints. So within here, then, you find synoviocytes, and they face the articular environment and a layer of areolar and adipose connective tissue that lie deep to the synovocytes, and it kind of supports them. It is the synovocytes that secrete the synovial fluid, as I said, and that, of course, lubricates and nourishes the cartilage covering the bones of the joint, and we'll be spending a lot of time on that in Clinical Anatomy 1. So we can see here, we've got this joint that comes together with this fibrous capsule around it, and then we have this layer, the synovial layer here, that secretes the fluid into the space. You can sort of see it here where the radius ulna here, this is sort of the beginning where the wrist would be, and you can see the sort of the synovial membrane around it. And that's it for that. All right. How many people have heard this word? Homeostasis. What is it? What is homeostasis? Balancing the body? What else? Sorry? Okay, and you said regulating. Okay, anything else? Kind of. I'll argue that, but shortly. And so, to some degree, you're not incorrect. I don't mean it that way, but yeah. Okay. Okay. Right. So we're hearing a lot of balance, even, that kind of stuff, right? All right. We're going to discover that homeostasis, I don't like the word. When you break it down, homeo is sameness and stasis is standing still. Never, ever is homeostasis standing still. Not ever. Is it warm in here? No? I find it warm in here. If it was warm in here, what would you be doing? Right? If it was cold in here, what would you be doing? Right. So you're always, within this external environment and internal environment, there's always things that are pushing against change. And because we live in such a dynamic environment, homeostasis is constantly pulling us one way or the other to try to maintain balance and evenness, but it's always getting pulled one way or the other. It's too cold, it's too hot, too acidic, too alkaline, too wet, too dry, right? That's always something the body is fighting against no matter what we do. So it is a bit of a, again, the name is not my favorite when you break it down as to what it's saying. So homeostasis is balance. Its true definition is the condition of equilibrium in the body's internal environment due to the interplay of the body's regulatory processes. How many regulatory processes do we have? Many. What are some of the things that we have to maintain or regulate? Core temperature, what else? Blood pressure, pH, blood sugar, oxygen, yeah, tons. Do you think about it? No. Which is really cool, right? It's got all this stuff going on that you don't even aren't aware of. Unless it gets too far one way or the other, and then what happens? You feel kind of crappy, right? You're too hot, you're too cold, you're too dry, you're too wet, right? And that's what sickness is that quite often when we're in a position where we're not well, a homeostasis has been driven so far out to one way or the other, the patient represents themselves as feeling unwell because no longer are they working it. Now, the one thing to remember when we talk about this balance and this evenness, it is the, when we look at all these regulatory processes, there is a parameter of high or low within a parameter that is an environment that makes those processes or regulatory processes more efficient. Does that make sense? So it's determined that a certain amount of pH in the system regulates that processes will work better, and if it gets too acidic or too alkaline, it doesn't work as well. So I want you to remember, well, as we go through this, is that there are two sides to homeostasis. I am going to talk about it a bit, but I'm going to sort of write it or draw it on here just to begin with. Okay, so we've got a line. And we've got right to right here, and then we're left here, okay? At any given time, whether we're talking glucose levels, pH levels, or whatever it is, there is a parameter that's best. So within, I'm sorry, is anybody willing to disclose here? Is anybody here diabetic? Any diabetics? Everybody know diabetics, well, brothers, sisters, whatever? What's normal blood level? Sugar. That's high.
Oh, no, sorry.
No blood. Or sugar. How? So that's 7. That's actually high. Yeah. 4.5 to 5.5. Okay? Right. But what's interesting is when they're diabetic, they feel good when it's at 7. They don't feel good when it's at 4.5 to 5.
No, I have a
7? That is a bit high, actually. So, blood sugar then, 4.5 to 5.5. Okay? Anywhere, either way, then processes don't work as well, whatever they may be. Okay? So, I want you to, everything you think about with all the regulatory processes, every single one has a parameter. Now, in some cases, the parameter is that wide, and you can kind of get away with it a little bit. In other cases, see if I can find a different color here. In some cases, the parameter is only there. And when it comes to pH, even coming this far or this far leads to death. All right? So this is something that, you know, depending on the regulatory process you're talking about, you can't remove yourself very far from where the normal parameters are. So homeostasis, the reality is, it's either too hot or too cold. It's always trying to drive the arrow one way or the other. And the body is always working to maintain the normal parameter, whatever that is. pH, blood glucose, so on and so forth. Everybody follow? Okay, so we can say that homeostasis is dynamic and ceaseless. So you're always regulating, no matter what. Okay? You had everybody ate before they probably came to class today. So now you're getting lots of glucose in your bloodstream. You're having to deal with that because you had a meal. We've got to keep the glucose down. So, you know, what does the body release to get blood glucose down? Insulin drives glucose into the cells, keeps the blood levels of glucose at the appropriate amount, right? Okay, so you're always ceaseless. The range to maintain life is very narrow, and the body does shift within this range. In other words, it has a bit of a range, and this creates a stable internal environment. All structures from cells to organ systems work to maintain homeostasis, and failure to maintain homeostasis leads to illness. So here's another back pocket thing to remember. In pathological states, quite often the signs and symptoms you're seeing of said disease is the body's reaction to being very far out of balance. Hence the reason why you're seeing what you're seeing. Things aren't working right. So the body's attempting, but it's just not functioning properly. Okay? There are other reasons for the illness, but one is it's the body recognizes it's shifting too far one way or the other. The need to maintain balance of anything requires a set of parameters that allow the body to work at its functional best. This means that within the set parameter, there is the optimum center with both a left and right, high and low. So generally, if it moves to the left, it's high, and if it moves to the right, it's low. So this side is high, and this side is low. So blood sugar got too much. Blood sugar is going up. Eat a set of big chocolate bar. Which way are you going? We say that it's shifting to the, right? Okay, did I put that in wrong? Yeah, high to the left and low to the right. So it's shifting to the left if the blood sugar gets too high. pH starts to become more alkaline, you're shifting to the right, which is low. Okay, so you're going to hear that term once in a while from a medical perspective in terms of shifts. Sorry? Okay. It's just what they use. It's just the way they use it. It's used when we look at these parameters. So we do have optimum center, correct? Okay, so if this is, in this case, we'll just stay with the blood, and we say it's 5.0 is the optimum center. If it starts going, I've got this backwards in me, that's why it's confusing, I apologize. Okay, let's do it this way, right? So 5.9, and we can do this and go 1.2. You can see that depending on what's going on, if someone comes in and they're hypoglycemic, which means low blood sugar, we say that they've shifted to the right. Okay, yeah.
What is an example of one that's the other
way? Oh, anything. Take your pick. Like, you mean where it's getting too high?
This is like where left is lower. I mean.
No, it never changes. It's always left is high and right is low. Yeah, so you'll look at research and they'll say, you know, using this medication today, we found pH values that shifted left. So that's the reason why it's kind of important to have a sense of that, where the shifts are. What you need to understand is, though, this is always going one way or the other, trying to maintain the optimum center. That's fundamentally what homeostasis is. Okay? That's generally what's happening. At either end, the values reach a point where the body will be stressed, and if it moves further, the body will be in crisis to a point where they can die. So quite often, this is what happens when people are quite ill, like with end stage of cancer. The functioning homeostatic mechanisms don't work much anymore because of the disease state. And quite often, usually it's opportunistic infections that get in, they get sepsis. That's usually the number one cause for their demise. But for example, COPD. Everybody knows what COPD is? Emphysema or chronic bronchitis. Everybody knows emphysema. Okay. So these folks, they can take a big breath in, and they can't blow anything out, okay, because of the damage that's been done to the lung tissue. So they start to store a gas called carbon dioxide because they can't breathe out. Carbon dioxide is acidic, okay? So when people are in end-stage COPD, they haven't the ability to get rid of carbon dioxide, and their blood levels start to become more acidic. It only has to drop one point, and they're in danger of dying. When I say point, I mean 0.1. Okay, 6.4 is the norm. If they go to 6.3, everybody's having a panic in the hospital. If they go to 6.2, uh-oh, you can die. Because it changes the environment. In an acidic environment, normal bodily functions can't occur. You all experience this. Who work out and lift weights, what's it feel like on your last two reps in your last set? Burning like a bugger, right? Because you created lactic acid in the environment, and that burn is because you created such an acidic environment, you're weak. The muscle can't work anymore, right? Because you're just trying so hard. It's because the acidic environment, the interaction of the structures of the muscle can't function properly anymore. No different than if your pH changes with a disease like COPD, nothing functions anymore, and you go downhill very quickly. So what they do, if you're in crisis with something like COPD, you go into the emerge department, and the respiratory therapist takes a very small needle and sticks it right in your radial artery and takes radial blood out. Yes. COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So what happens in emphysema, the disease state takes all the small little grapes, alveoli in the lung, and bursts them. So you get big air pockets in these lungs that can't function very well, and they hold on to and retain gases. So yeah, they'll do a blood gas, and what they do is they literally take the blood artery-wise. So like, they don't take it out of a vein like you normally get blood out of. They go right into the artery in your wrist. It does not feel well because they have to go very, very deep to get all the way in there. And then, of course, when they're done, they have to push very, very hard because it's an artery, because they don't want it squirting out. And then they take the blood down to a machine and they measure it, and then sometimes all hell breaks loose because it's the easiest to get at.
Oh.
It's from an arterial point of view, the radial artery. That's why you guys starting, I guess you haven't taken pulses yet, have you? Now you'll probably do that this week, right? That's why we use the radial artery, because it's easily accessible, and that's where they'll go in with you. Unless you like them when you're carotid.
That?
Because it's oxygenated blood. They need that oxygenated blood coming directly from the lungs to measure its acidic value. No. Artery is oxygenated. It's come directly from the lungs. Veins are, yes. Well, they're deoxygenated. Correct. So we say here, the normal parameter can move, for example, normal blood sugars between 4 and 6. Millimoles per liter. In diabetics, they feel best at between 8 and 10 millimoles per liter. In fact, to sort of answer a bit of what you were thinking with the child, it's not unusual for the endocrinologist to maintain a bit of a higher level for the diabetic because they seem to be functioning better and they feel better. It's almost like their comfort level has shifted over here now because they've been there for so long. And they really don't feel well when they get back to our normal. They don't like it. Possibly. Yeah, there's always underlying other things for sure. But that's the normal range that we consider for all of us to work with. No, active actually lowers blood sugar.
Well,
So chronic high blood sugar, and this is what happens to diabetics in later years when they become older adults, because their blood sugar hasn't been managed well all their lives, then the amputation starts. So they get neuropathies and all sorts of things. Tissues die in the periphery, and they end up, first they lose a toe, then their foot, then the lower leg, and so forth, because that over long-standing high amounts of sugars slowly starts breaking down blood vessels, nerves, and all those sorts of things, and it just doesn't bode well for them. So this is why, if you know anybody who is a diabetic and they're really lousy at maintaining their sugars, which they all do at some point, and they crave sweets. It's nuts. I had a buddy. Yeah, I had a buddy who was a really bad diabetic. He actually went blind at 25 because his diabetes was so bad. If you went in his freezer, he'd have 10 ice cream buckets in there, right? It's nuts. Yes. Oh, it could be. I don't know. I'd have to know the other side of it to be able to say. So in other words, homeostasis rules. I made a shirt one time. I'd have little competitions in class, and if a student won a competition, they get a T-shirt that says homeostasis rule in it. Yeah, except for the stupid idiots who didn't understand what homeostasis was and thought it meant something else. So, you get my drift. So, we must remember that we are constantly bombarded with stimuli that can disrupt or take the body away from balance. So this is why I don't like the term stasis, not moving, because in fact we are always doing this, right? Too hot, too cold, too sweet, not sweet enough, so on and so forth, right? This may exist within or outside the body. So, too hot, too cold obviously is the external environment, but many things happen internally that we need to maintain, like I said, blood sugar, oxygen levels, temperature, and so on and so forth. Stresses can also play a role in changing the balanced environment. So this is going to be a new term for many of you, psychoneuroimmunological effects. In other words, your mental health affects your ability to maintain homeostasis and wellness. When you're stressed out, you have a far greater chance of getting ill because that stress starts to break down your immune system or affect it, that it doesn't work as well. So the body, when you're stressed out, loses a bit of ability to maintain appropriate balance in all the regulatory systems. Okay? Big new research on all this stuff now, which anecdotally people used to say makes sense. Someone's depressed and not feeling well, they tend to get sick more. The longer the influence towards the imbalance, the more severe the possibility of a mortal outcome. Okay? Now, there are two systems that control this. One is very quick, but doesn't last for very long. The other is very slow and lasts a very long period of time. So the quick system is the nervous system, and it uses nerve impulses directly to from the central nervous system to organs and so forth to affect change. But it travels very quickly because it's running down the neural pathways, and it's quick, but these influences, they don't last very long. They're just quick fixes. Yes, to some degree, yes. Yes. The endocrine system is the slow system, and it uses chemicals called hormones to affect change. It's much more powerful between the two. It is slower to affect change, but lasts for very long periods of time. So depending on what's required at the time to maintain homeostasis, it can either be a quick neural hit or a more sustained, longer endocrine or hormonal hit to affect change as far as that goes. Any questions? We will get there. It'll be in here for sure. Okay. So, how does that happen? So, how do you know it's cold? So, how do you know you're cold? You feel it. How do you feel? Okay. How do you feel? Okay. What's that? No, but how do you know you're cold? I'm being esoteric here. How do you know you're cold? How do you know anything? Okay, everybody, put your pens down. Give yourself a bit of space. Stick your hands out like this. Like this. Close your eyes. And with your right hand, with your eyes closed, touch your nose. Okay, how are you able to do that? Your eyes are closed. Now muscle memory. Yeah, it is spatial awareness. Where does spatial awareness come from? Yeah. Well, the brain has... brain doesn't know anything. It's in your head. Your brain is your the big controller of things, but the brain doesn't know what's going on outside. It's stuck here in the cranium. How does the brain know it's cold? No.
Nope.
Yeah, receptors that are responsible for too hot, too cold, too sweet, too acidic, too alkaline. They're responsible for that alone. So your ability to know it's cold means you have receptors in your body that are telling the brain, holy cow, it's cold. At the same time, you know, you fly here from Toronto at, you know, 40 below and your plane arrives in Hawaii at 41 above, you're going to step out of the plane and go, holy cow, it's hot. Because receptors are telling your brain it's hot. Receptors are telling your brain there's too much glucose in your blood. Receptors are telling your brain lots of things all the time. So we have to have a system where the brain is kept aware, because it's the major controller, of where all these regulatory processes are day to day. Okay? So it's called a feedback mechanism. And it, the definition within a system, a feedback system, is a cycle of events in which the status of the body condition is monitored. How are we doing? Evaluated. And when it's evaluated, it's where does it fit on this? And that parameter can represent sugar, which you've written down here. It can also represent temperature and so on and so forth. So you have a receptor that is monitoring, and then you have something that evaluates it. So it compares what the monitor is saying to the parameter, and then the brain goes, it's too far right or too far left, and then changes occur. Everybody following me so far? Yeah, eventually, yeah. It's always either going high or going low, right? Again, you know, so you haven't eaten for 4 days. You're on this new fad called fasting. What? Yeah, okay, sure. Okay. So you're not eating. You need blood sugar. Where do you get sugar? No, you're not eating. Right, so you have another hormone instead of insulin, which makes sugar disappear out of the blood. You have something called glucagon, which forces the body to release sugar to maintain the parameter. Does anybody here fast? Curious questions. And how long are you kind of wonky for? Yeah, because your sugars are getting all kind of wonky and because you're not eating and so forth, right? And you are forcing your body to take its own stores, such as adipose tissue, breaking down protein, and so on and so forth, right? So we do have the ability to do that, but it just means it's always swinging high or low depending on whatever's happening. So because of that, monitored, evaluated, changed, remonitored, and reevaluated, we need some key components in this system in order to maintain homeostasis. The first is the receptor. The receptor monitors and sends messages to the control center, and it can send that message to the control center either through nerve impulses or through chemicals. And it isn't that there's one receptor that does everything. Please understand that, right? So even with your skin, so we say skin feels heat, cold, pressure, and tickle, okay? It is not one receptor that does that. You have a receptor for tickle, you have a receptor for heat, you have a receptor for cold, you have a receptor for pressure, you have a nociceptor for pain. You have all these special different receptors that are responsible for all these different things that can occur. Same thing happens here. Oops. Taste buds are an organ. Not anymore. That's all been debunked. Yeah, I got an article I'll show you later. Yeah. In fact, I thought about doing it. I found this thing online where you would partner up and you would have a little thing of sweet, sour, acid, and so forth, and you'd map each other's tongues. And you literally touch different areas, and both of your tongues will be different. It's not as straightforward as what we learned in school. It's not that straightforward anymore. Yeah. Sorry? About 2 years ago. Yeah. We followed a particular, that map, and it was actually wrong. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, certain, well, every one of those little fingers that make up your tongue, they're all receptors that are sensitive to one thing or another, depending on what's going on. Right? So it's sweet, salt, and sour, and there's a fourth one. And then the fifth, you got it. Very Asian. They are the ones that discovered it. That's why Asian food tastes so good, is because of umami. Yes. Yeah, it does. Tomatoes, anchovies, all cause umami. So if I make a spaghetti sauce, like a really normal meat spaghetti sauce, I put anchovies in it. Two anchovies to a pot of spaghetti, you'll never taste it, but the umami is there because the anchovies give a beautiful unctuousness to it.
Really?
And tomato sauce. Try it. Anchovies. Yep, they dissolve, you'll never see them. Yeah, bolognese, yeah. Try it. Okay, so we've got a receptor that's monitoring. Then we have a control center where the message has to go. So it sets the range of values within the predetermined parameter. It evaluates what it's getting from the receptor against the parameters, and then depending on where the evaluation is within the parameter, sends a message via nerve impulse or chemical. So in your brain, which is the control center, it knows the parameter for every single process in your body. And the receptor sends a message to the brain, and it determines whether it needs more or less, or it's okay with every single process that happens in the body. Okay? Then we have what's called the effector. This is the part that receives the message from the control center. So you eat a chocolate bar. The receptor notices that the glucose levels in the blood are going up because you had a big chocolate bar. And the control center recognizes it's too sweet. The control center then sends a message to the pancreas to say, please squirt out some insulin to get things back to normal. Okay? Yeah. Yep. Yes. That tends to be more man-made. So, for example, someone comes in and they're in a sugar coma because the sugar in their blood is so high they're unconscious. They'll give them medications to lower, and sometimes it gets a little too low. And then, what's that?
Nitro?
Well, nitro can get too low. Well, yeah, but you got to take a lot of nitro to really do a number.
What would
cause the euphoric
feeling after, like
anoxia?
Yeah. Like really
lack of oxygen in the brain, so you get high. Anoxia, lack of oxygen. So if you're drowning, you get. Because many people said, even when they're dying, they feel kind of like, yeah, yep. I think it's kind of a mechanism where the body says, I'm going to make you feel good because you're going to die at any moment. So, we can see here, we've got something that disrupts homeostasis. The receptor is monitoring at that level what's going on. So the stimulus is either increasing or decreasing whatever it is. In other words, moving it along the continuum here within the parameters, outside or maybe even outside. So the receptor says, oh, things are getting too much or not enough. Then it sends a message to the control center that receives the message from the receptor, and then the control center sends a message to the particular organ or structure that needs to secrete the hormone or whatever it may be. That then alters the control condition. So if sugar is too high, control center sends something to the pancreas, it secretes insulin, blood sugar starts going down. Well, we need the receptor to also measure that blood sugar is going down, because if we don't, the pancreas will continue to secrete insulin, and what will happen to blood sugar? It'll get too low, and that's just as dangerous as being too high. You can die from too low of blood sugar, too. Yes? Correct. Yeah, so between this line and this line, with the perfect center, that's what all of these three parts are trying to do. They don't want it to get too far this way or that way, because then you run into trouble. So it's never perfect, but it's always trying to get right back to that sweet spot with little movements here, there, and everywhere. And then when you run into problems like the pancreas stops producing insulin, then all of a sudden it starts shifting that high-end blood sugars to start going up, because the pancreas is unable to produce insulin to help it, which is type 1 diabetes, right? Or juvenile diabetes. But juvenile diabetes also has some other symptoms along with it. So that's it in a nutshell. You get the change that happens, and then it gets monitored yet again. And once whatever was shifting this way gets affected to come back this way. And once it gets back to the right part this way, the receptor says, stop telling the pancreas to secrete insulin, and it does, and then we're kind of where we need to be. So you have to, the receptor is always working with this, because I said it's always, so you know, now you know why I don't like the word stasis, because this is reality, this is really what homeostasis is doing, right? Always trying to maintain against whatever's happened to it. So there are two types of feedback systems in the body. The first is called the negative feedback system. Now, the negative feedback system is reversing the change. So if the blood sugar is too high, it's reversing the change to make it more normal, so lower. If blood sugar is too low, it's affecting change to bring blood sugar back up high, so it's reversing whatever the change is. If you're too hot, you're going to sweat to try to cool down. If you're too cold and you're shivering, you're trying to warm up through muscle contractions, right? Okay, so you can see that a negative feedback system is reversing the change from what it is. Too high, back to low, or too low, back to up, to where it is.
Are the changes generally from the stimuli?
What is stimuli? So again, everything we just went through in terms of this is actually this. So blood sugar got too high. The message was sent to the pancreas to secrete insulin. Blood sugar came down. In other words, reversing the change. Okay? It slows and eventually stops as the environment returns to balance. So it isn't that the pancreas squirts out a bunch of insulin and then affects change. The ongoing secretion of insulin from the pancreas is measured by that receptor. And maybe initially the blood sugar got so high that the signal is quite strong to the pancreas and it starts to secrete a fairly large amount of insulin. But as the blood sugar drops from high, the receptor starts to note that, sends a message to the control center, oh, we're getting closer to normal. So the message from the control center to the pancreas starts to slow down and the pancreas starts to stop secreting so much insulin until eventually everything comes back to, right? Everybody follow? Okay. So when you're affecting change, reversing it, this is known as a negative feedback system. So everything we just talked about, too much pH, not enough pH, too much blood sugar, too hot, too cold, that's all negative feedbacks. The other type of a feedback is a positive feedback system, and that is a system that strengthens or reinforces the change. So the other one was all about reversing it. This is all about supporting it and making it stronger. Similar to positive feedback, but it continues until an outside system shuts it off. Can anybody tell me an example of a positive feedback mechanism? In labor, right. So here's what happens. Baby shifts down into the mouth of the uterus, and in doing so, the head starts to stretch the mouth of the uterus. That stretching of the uterus is registered by a receptor that sends a message to the brain, the uterus is stretched. The brain then sends chemicals that has uterine contractions occur. In doing so, when the uterus contracts, the head is pushed down farther and stretches the uterus even further. The greater stretch of the uterus sends a stronger message from the receptors in the uterus to the brain to stimulate even more uterine contractions, and the head slips down further and you get more stretch and you get a stronger signal and the brain sends more chemical and you get another contraction, the brain and the head goes further and the uterus stretches even more and a stronger signal and on and on and on and on until baby's out. Just like that. I had two of them. I didn't feel a thing. And that is a positive system. We're promoting uterine contractions to birth the child. The negative feedback system would have it not happen, pulling it back, but the positive is forcing the issue to happen. Yeah.
So, question, when you're lifting weights, you get
micro tears
in your muscles
that
cause
it
to grow.
Yep.
Is that a positive or a negative
feedback to heal? It's not either. It's a stress response. So, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But it is a stress response. So you've forced the system to make changes to meet the demand. So you stress the body enough to say, I can't do this. I need to make changes so I can do it next time. So therefore, the actinomycin become thicker and stronger, and therefore you become stronger because of it. So everybody follow that? So a negative reverses the action and a positive promotes the action. Okay? So it's right here. You can see here contractions of the wall of the uterus force the baby's head or body into the cervix, which results in stretching of the cervix. And then you get stretch-sensitive nerve cells that are receptors, send a message to the brain. It interprets what the receptors are saying, and then the brain outputs something called oxytocin, which stimulates uterine contracture. Of course, the baby's head goes farther down. You get more of uterine stretch, which continues to promote the whole system until baby comes out. And for those who've had babies, what has to come next? Because it doesn't stop there. Yep. And then when that's gone, do the contractions just immediately stop? No, they slowly come back to normal because there's that chemical still kind of around and so forth. Oh, I have no idea. I don't know. I don't think. Did you have an emergency or was it planned? Okay. I'd love to see a cesarean. It would be awesome. Yeah, maybe. Just do whatever. Sorry? A C-section? Yeah, in a heartbeat. Absolutely. I get off on all that stuff. I'd get in there with both hands. Blood right up to here? Absolutely. That doesn't bother me in the slightest. No. No, I think it's cool. I get off on that rush a lot. That's why I liked working in the emergency department. Yeah. So when we talk about homeostatic imbalances, at balance, all things function efficiently. So that's the whole point of this parameter and this sweet spot in the center, is that as long as everything is maintained within its parameter, everything works the best, no matter what everything is, right? So you want to be in there. Out of balance, so any shift out of the optimum results in disease or disorder, okay? It's as simple as that. So I said, when you get to PATH class and you're looking at diseases and some of the signs and symptoms, some of that, in fact, is of the fact that the disease has taken the body, to some degree, out of homeostasis. So we're going to talk a bit about something that has to be maintained in the body, and this is acids and bases. So we have a particular, depending on where you are in the human body and what gender you are, those sorts of things, we have various different acidic environments in our body. So blood has a particular acidic environment that it sits in, and the stomach and so forth. So this is one of the major things that does help control homeostasis and appropriate function in the body, is the control of acids and bases. So a definition here. Does everybody know what electrolyte is? I don't know if I can see any around today. Is anybody drinking electrolytes today? Is everybody just drinking water? Gatorade? Oh, coffee. Hey, I have a question because I can see some of the big jugs here. Where did the drink 8 glasses of water a day come from? Nobody knows because it's been proven that you don't have to. Correct. No. Yeah. Coffee is as much water as water is. It's fluids. You get side effects from that stuff. But that 8 glasses a day, no one knows where it came from, and there's no research or science to prove it. Mm-hmm. Now, are we dehydrated a lot? Yeah, sure, you should want to maintain some fluid levels for sure. But yeah, that 8 glasses a day, no one knows where it came from. It's everybody's just gone with it. It's one of those. What do you call them? Pop culture kind of things everybody believes in. So I get a kick out of these people who've got like the mammoth water thing. Can you drink too much water and kill yourself? Absolutely. Yeah, hyperhidrosis is called, and you can die. Gatorade. Nobody here should be drinking Gatorade. At all whatsoever. There's no need for it. Not ever. Unless you're running marathons and you're burning that much chemical in your body for heavy-duty workouts. That's fine for that. But, yeah, that's something a bit different. But Gatorade was actually purchased by Coca-Cola and became a health drink to a crap drink. No, Coca-Cola used to be made from cocaine. You used to have Coke in your Coca-Cola. Yeah. I don't think there's anybody alive anymore that would have drank Coca-Cola when it had Coke in it, because that was in the teens. You sure? Interesting. I'll have to go try that. I have ADHD, cocaine, and I get along really well. So, Gatorade is a form of electrolyte. So an electrolyte is a solution that contains ions and lots of water. What's an ion?
A negatively charged atom.
Yeah, negative or
positive.
Right, so an ion, so a cation and an anion would be the two. But so an electrolyte is a solution that has compounds in it that have a charge. Okay? They're extremely important in all the functions in the human body. You cannot have a heartbeat. You cannot move a muscle without having electrolytes and charges. We're going to learn that when we have things happen in the body, we need differences in charge inside and outside a cell. And without that, we can't do anything. Yep. No, it's more spaces.
It's space.
Yeah, the fluid. Whatever. They have charges. They're compounds with charges. That's correct. So, the best way to explain ions, if I had you go into a bathtub and plug in a toaster and put it on and throw it in the tub with you, you might get electrocuted. If I took the same tub and put a bag of Epsom salts in there, I guarantee you would be electrocuted. Because salt is an ion, and it conducts electricity. Water, pure distilled water, is not a great conductor of electricity, as compared to water that has ions in it. No, it's just it. You'd still get a zap, but you want to put salt in there, you're guaranteed the current's running right through you. Hence the reason why we electrocute so easily, because we are full of ions. No, when you put salt in your water to boil faster for pasta, you've actually changed the atmosphere. When does water boil faster, high on a mountain or down in the ocean? Yeah. You're changing the atmosphere when you add salt. Because the lower you get, the saltier things become. Yeah. Sorry, you had a question? Until a certain point, the same is there where you get too high, and you become what's it called? Hypernatremia. Yeah, and then again, if you get too much, you can die. The lethal injection. What do you get? Anybody know?
Potassium.
Yeah. Potassium stops your heart like that. So in certain those who have kidney disease, who go to dialysis, they die a lot. Now, when I worked in the hospital, we got codes in the dialysis unit all the time because the dialysis unit, it certainly doesn't work as well as a kidney. And these individuals get really screwed up chemicals in their body. So the dialysis machine actually takes too much potassium out of them, for example, which the normal kidney wouldn't. And they go into a code right while they're on the machine because they end up with too much potassium. Potassium blocks the ability for the heart to beat, and it stops. Yeah, good question, right? Who knows? Standard. So, as I said, electrolytes, you can't function without them, okay? Nervous conduction and muscle contraction would be impossible without electrolytes. Your brain couldn't even function without it. You need electrolytes in order to function. When electrolytes are placed in water, they divide into positive and negative ions, known as cations and anions. Besides you, does anybody else here remember that? Kind of one, yeah, two. Yeah. I guess you get the option now, eh? You don't have to take chemistry anymore in high school? Okay. So we're going to learn. Look at that. Because, again, just trying to bring context into things, okay? So a muscle cell membrane is here, okay? A normal resting muscle cell membrane looks like this. Where are we here? Okay, so inside the cell is more positively charged, and outside the cell is more negatively charged. This is vitally important. Without that, you don't get nervous conduction or muscle contraction, including your heart, right? And those charges get flipped when we have a muscle contraction. So where do those charges come from? They come from electrolytes. Sodium, how do you write sodium? Na. Right. Looks like this. That is electrolyte. It's a positive charge. That's sodium. Yep. Yes.
Is an
electrolyte
only one of the
Yeah, you have to. A salt is, it has to dissociate.
Okay.
It still has to be on its own in order to be able to provide the charge that's required, right? So, but what we do is at the cell membrane, we're going to learn that there's little pumps that occur that are pump things either one way or the other. So in cells, they're pumping sodium. What's that? Right. Don't worry, you're all going
to
learn that. It's coming up. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Correct. Sodium chloride's written a bit differently because you got two. So they can dissociate into sodium and chloride depending on what we're doing. Okay? So when you're drinking Gatorade, all they've done is put a bunch of potassium and a whole bucket load of salt and sugar, and that's what they call an electrolyte, right? What's the best electrolyte you can buy? All bananas are good, like drink-wise. Coconut water. When I used to do big workouts, I drink coconut water. Stuff's awesome. It does, and it's not high in sugars. Whereas Coca-Cola, once they bought Gatorade, just started throwing buckets of sugar in the Gatorade. So, we can see here, when we're looking at electrolytes, your intake per day of electrolytes between what your metabolism creates, the food you eat, and what you drink sort of represents what goes in. The ions or the electrolytes that you get rid of in day-to-day life, you lose 4% through your feces, 8% in your sweat. There are insensible losses via skin and lungs at about 28%, and urine's about 60%. So you are constantly, through metabolic processes, dumping off electrolytes, so you always have to maintain to try to get them back. But they'll make you believe that, you know, drinking Powerade or whatever is the way to do it. There's many other ways, just in your day-to-day eating, right? Eating fruits and vegetables. And that's the important thing as well, that all you'll hear me interject about a little bit, is proper diet is what you need at the end of the day of all of this, right? So processed foods, what do? They basically destroy anything that's to some degree, right? They're manufactured and so forth, right? So, you know, if you've got a chance to eat an orange instead of drink orange juice, you're going to benefit more from it, right? Yes.
That's why they say if you're trying to survive, that you should drink your urine because of all the electrolytes that are in it?
Well, you shouldn't, because there's actually toxins in there too.
So why do they say? I don't think it's just a...
They don't really, although your Vedic medicine says otherwise, doesn't it? Yes, it does. Your Vedic medicine suggests that you should drink your urine first thing in the morning when it's strong. What is it, an ounce? About an ounce a day? Ish, somewhere in there, something like that?
Urine.
I thought you drank your own urine in your Vedic medicine. I was always taught that you do. I had a teacher when I went to school, he drank an ounce of his urine every morning. Yeah. Yeah, what's that? It's sterile. So urine is not, it's sterile when it comes out of the body, unless you have a UTI or something, but it's completely sterile. What's that? It takes a bit of time though. Once it has to get out first, but if it's directly out of the urethra, it's sterile.
Yeah, I don't
sure. No, it is. It is. It's sterile. Urine is sterile when it first leaves the body. Honestly, so it's completely filtered. Now, catheter is different. That's not directly out of the body. Because it has time to have interaction. Okay? So, yes, urine will become bad really quickly. All you have to do is give it an hour, and what's it smell like if it's an adult wearing a diaper? It's not nice, generally. You're getting bacterial growth within it. But directly out of the urethra, it's actually sterile. Because it's got all kinds of other toxins in it. It's got uric acid and a number of things. I mean, if a very short term, but there's lots of stories where men who had sinking ships in World War II and would be in dinghies, of course, of salt water, they can't drink it. The first thing they would do is attempt to drink their own urine, and it made them vilely ill.
Really?
Yeah, Dune, right? Dune in their suits, right? The urine goes in and gets filtered, and then they get fresh water back. I'm a science fiction freak, so. All right, so that being... Oh, hang on, take a break. Sorry, I didn't realize it was that late. Take a break. Yep. Top of the hour. Sorry about that. I didn't realize it was that late. Okay, so we've got these metabolites, and we discovered that, you know, acids and bases play a pretty important role in normal metabolism. So both intracellular and extracellular environments must have balanced quantities of acids and bases. So intracellular would be the environment within the cell membrane, the cell itself. Extracellular environment, of course, would be the environment that sits outside the cell membrane around it. So we need these various levels of percent hydrogen, acid or base, for, again, functions to occur in the human body that are happening at any time. In a solution, The more hydrogen ions we find, the more acidic the solution becomes. So when we say white vinegar, for example, there's a ton of hydrogen in that. That's what makes it acidic. And then, of course, the more acidic something becomes, certain compounds, acetylsalicylic acid, stomach acid juice, all that kind of stuff, we just get a higher and higher and higher amount of hydrogen that makes it what we call acidic. The more hydroxide ions, sorry, so we're saying that when we say that in the solution there's more hydrogen ions, what happens is when we take the solution, we dissolve it in water, it dissociates into one or more hydrogen ions. Now, water is what is called the universal solvent. So, we got a beaker of water, and we're going to put in a tablespoon or two of salt. Give it a stir, and what happens? Dissolves. But it actually, dissolve is not an incorrect word. It actually dissociates. Right? So, table salt is sodium chloride. One's negative, one's positive. Water is considered what's called polar. So it has a positive side and a negative side. So what happens is when you put the salt in the water, sodium chloride, because water molecules are polarized, one side negative, one side positive, the negative side attracts the positive part of the salt, and the positive side attracts the negative part of the salt, and before your very eyes, sodium chloride doesn't exist anymore, because you've pulled chloride and sodium away, and in your eyes, the naked eye, it disappears, because the water pulled it apart. So when we say here, in a solution, the more hydrogen ions we find, the more acidic the solution becomes. When dissolved in water, the solution dissociates into one or more hydrogen ions. So we take that vinegar and we pour it in distilled water, we can then measure the amount of hydrogen ions in it, and that will define how acidic it is. Okay? Let me finish, just because it has to flow here for a moment. Okay, so the more hydroxide ions we find, so if I take a solution and I put it in distilled water, I don't see hydrogen, I see all kinds of hydroxide ions. That solution is considered to be base. So extensive amounts of hydrogen equals acidic, and lots of hydroxide equals alkaline. Remember, alkaline is also known as base. Okay? So we've got vinegar that would be an acid. What's an example of a base? Sorry? Well, that's the extreme end. Okay, okay. What else? Sorry? Baking soda. Right. Can a base do as much damage to the human body as an acid can? Yes. Absolutely. Okay? So again, continuum either side, you can get damage. Okay? So, when it's an acid, you get lots of hydrogen. When it's an alkaline, you get lots of hydroxide. When we add a base to an acid, what happens is it removes the hydrogen from that solution, making it more base. In other words, the hydrogen gets used to make hydroxide, and the hydrogen disappears in the solution, so it becomes more base. More neutral. Fair enough. So it's working its way back to...
And they just make water.
Right. Eventually, if they're equal.
Yeah.
If they're equal. Okay? So this is why you can have... I'm trying to give a good example. Volcano. Elementary school volcano. Right. So what's happened? You applied an alkaline to an acid, and look what happened. Yeah, it reacts together. So that's fundamentally what happens in the human body. We're going to discover is how we control acid levels by using bases to control how acidic your environment is or isn't. So we need both. Just a bit in this section. No, but this will come back in path. So because I'm telling you how the body works normally, so we're going to find that certain pathological processes bugger it up. So you need to understand what happens normally so you have an understanding of what happens when things go bad. So So if I say to you, you know, COPD, you end up with excessive carbon dioxide, that changes pH to a more acidic environment, you get a sense of kind of what's happening.
Because
the carbon dioxide is actually acidic. Carbon dioxide is actually acidic.
Right, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so what's important here is when we add a base to an acid, it removes hydrogen, making the solution more base. So we have a scale called the pH scale, right there. And this pH scale stands for percent hydrogen, not hydroxide. So when we have a pH scale, we look at solutions and compounds, and we determine, depending upon how much hydrogen they have in them, whether that solution or compound is more acidic or more base. The one that surprises everybody is the banana. Is a banana more acidic or more base? Anybody else? It's actually acidic. A banana is actually acidic. But in your mouthfeel, it feels creamy, and we kind of learned that basics tend to be more smooth and creamy. Hence the reason why I can't stand squash. Yeah, I've discovered why. I mean, I'll eat it. Sweet potatoes and squash, kick them to the curb. I really don't care about them.
Would pineapple be basic?
No, it's acidic. But I found that the reason why I don't like squash is because I find that base foods don't agree with my palate. Right, I much prefer a more acidic type of food. Anyways, so we have to look at these and find out, you know, on the scale where they are. So the more hydrogen ions that exist in a solution, of course, the more acidic it is. And the more hydroxide ions, the more basic the solution is. Acidity or alkalinity is expressed on the pH scale, which runs from 0 to 14. The scale is based on the concentration of hydrogen in the solution. So in other words, when you look at a solution, the higher the hydrogen, the more acidic it is, and the less hydrogen, the more base it is. The midpoint on the scale is 7. 7 is completely neutral. It is neither acidic nor base, and that is represented by distilled water. It's completely no hydrogen, no hydroxide.
Okay.
Hydrogen is H, and hydroxide is OH. Now we need to talk about a salt. Okay, so we got to think of homeostasis, parameters, and so on and so forth. A salt, when added to water, dissociates into cations and anions, neither of which is hydrogen or hydroxide. So when you take a salt and you put it in water, you get positively charged compounds and negatively charged compounds, but it's neither hydrogen nor hydroxide. That's considered a salt. These salts are necessary to carry electrical charges, which, of course, nerve impulses or muscle contractions. When we have an acid and a base, and we put them in the same solution, they ultimately create a salt because they cancel each other out. Right? Remember, a salt has neither hydrogen nor hydroxide. So when we put the two together, they cancel each other out, and we get a salt. Okay? You're still going to create some salt from it for the interaction when we have the remaining there. That's a really important statement slash question because that's how we maintain pH. So we provide enough to get the pH in the appropriate environment, but if we put too much in and flipped it the other way, if it got too far on us, then you're looking at death. So, a solution alkalinity or acidity is measured on the pH scale, which means percent hydrogen. As I said, the pH of 7 is said to be neutral, neither alkaline nor acidic. As the number moves right, the solution becomes more alkaline. As the number moves right, 7 to 8 to 9 to 10, the solution is alkaline. As the number moves left, the solution becomes more acidic, 7 to 6. So if 7 is neutral, 7 to 8 to 9 to 10 is base, 7 to 6 to 5 to 4 is acidic. Everybody follow? Okay. It is important to understand that a change of one whole number represents a tenfold change in the number of hydrogen ions. What's tenfold? 10 by 10. Huge. So imagine then if you're talking about normal blood pH, a tenfold change in acidity in that blood, that's a huge change in the environment. So we don't ever want that. So if on the scale a change of 1 point is tenfold, then when we're looking at maintaining a parameter here, like this, we got to figure out some way to gently move things back and forth. We don't, because of that tenfold change. If we change pH one whole point, we're in trouble. So we have to figure out a system that gently moves the bar back and forth rather than big swings. Okay. Various intra and extracellular fluids have a specific pH value that they must maintain. So there's many, many areas of the body that have variations of alkalinity and acidity depending on where you are. Also, in certain parts, gender has an interesting interaction. As far as like sexual reproduction goes, I don't know if you guys know this, but the reality is the internal environment of a female is too acidic and sperm can't survive. Did you know that? So what happens then? How did we counteract that evolutionarily? We send out kamikaze sperm. And they go out and deliberately die, and their death alkalizes the environment so the sperm coming behind can get to where they need to go without dying because of the normal environment of the internal woman. Kind of cool, eh? I want to say 4 days, 5 days. I think it's 4 or 5, yeah, somewhere in there. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. They just keep swimming. So, as I said, because it's a tenfold change on 1 point, we don't want to change pH, we want to buffer pH. Think of buffer as gentle pushes rather than big swings. Okay? So, at the normal pH limits for each of these fluids are quite narrow. So, whether we're talking blood, vaginal secretions, mother's milk, mucus, and so on and so forth. They all have these very sort of narrowed percentages of hydrogen. Homeostatic mechanisms are constantly at work to maintain the appropriate values. So you have your kidneys that are always removing excess acid through urine, which helps maintain these hydrogen levels, as an example. We also blow some off. We also blow hydrogen off as well within our breathing. Strong acids are continually created by the body and consumed into the body, but pH levels in the body remain constant. How does this happen? And this is one of my pet peeves. How many people here drink alkaline water? It is. You know why? You maintain your own alkalinity and acidity. You don't need to drink alkaline water. There's no need to. Your body will take care of it for you. Yeah. What's that? Yeah. Yeah. No. You don't need it. Your body will take care of things yourself, right? And if you think about it, you know, because we do eat, North America, we do tend to have a fairly acidic palate. You think, you know, red wine and fish and chips, and all, we like acidic things. So, Why don't we like burn up, right? Because our body takes care of it. It knows if we've got too much hydrogen, we urinate it out and we maintain through homeostasis those levels. So when these things come out like alkaline water and that, I just go, oh, goodness gracious. Yeah. Well, okay, but he may be compromised in such a way that he can't maintain certain homeostatic mechanisms because of his condition. There can be times for certain things, but fundamentally, you know, because again, what happens is somebody comes up with something and suddenly the shelf of the grocery store has 15 different types of alkaline water charging ridiculous amounts for it. And then, you know, what the heck, right? Yeah. Oh, it's not. Oh. Interesting. Okay. That's kind of cool. But by the way, if you're living here in Barrie and you're new, the water here is horrendous. Barrie is horrendous. Horrendous water. This whole area does, no matter where you go. Penetang, Midland, or really, it's all heavy water. Yeah. Well, I always have a problem with distilled. From an osmotic perspective, there's no osmotically distilled water moves everything in the opposite direction. And if you're drinking, I would think anecdotally, if you're drinking distilled water, you're actually going to have electrolytes leave the body and go into the distilled water, because osmotically it's going to shift in that direction because there's nothing in distilled water. No, I don't think it is either. Because of the Barrie water. All my life, for the last 40 years, I have reverse osmosis systems. What's that? What, is distilled? It's not distilled, though. No, there's still compounds in it. It's not completely. No, I don't think so. I guess it's conceivable. Yeah, it can be. Okay, so we have to maintain pH levels. We have all these different environments. We have to maintain pH. The body requires a buffer system. And remember, like I said, a buffer system gently moves things within the parameter of the homeostasis definition. These buffer systems, their role is to convert a strong acid or base into a weak acid or base, not to remove it, it's to make it less strong.
When we were talking about the receptors and all that, would that have any?
Oh, receptors are reading this all the time. Absolutely. All over the place. Oh, absolutely. So strong acids or bases can ionize easily. In other words, release many hydrogen or hydroxide ions into a solution, which could result in a drastic change in pH. So again, remember, single point is tenfold. So we don't want to go single point, because that could shift things so extremely out of balance that it could result in being very unwell or dying. Weak acids or bases release much smaller amounts of hydrogen or hydroxide, thereby having less effect on pH. These compounds that convert the substance into either a weak base or an acid is known as a buffer. It's either removing or adding a hydrogen ion.
That's what a buffer is?
Yes. Okay. For example, protein buffer system. This is the most abundant buffer in intracellular fluid and blood plasma. Hemoglobin itself, which is a compound that you find in a red blood cell that actually carries the oxygen, hemoglobin is a good buffer within red blood cells. And albumin is the main buffer in blood plasma. So it's one of the albumin is one of those things they measure when they take blood out of your arm. It's a protein. Albumin is a protein. Where do you find it? You guys all eat it. Yep, it's the white of the egg. Okay, it's a type of protein. So albumin works very well. Due to the chemical makeup of proteins, they can buffer both acids and bases. Blood flows through the systemic capillaries, where carbon dioxide passes from the tissue into the red blood cells, where it then combines with water to form something called carbonic acid. The carbonic acid dissociates, which gives us a hydrogen atom. So in blood, CO2, so red blood cells carry oxygen out, right, to release oxygen into tissues that require it. Carbon dioxide, of course, has to leave the tissues as a byproduct of metabolism. And we breathe off carbon dioxide. Oxygen is mainly carried in the red blood cell. Carbon dioxide doesn't get carried that way the majority of the time. It has to be converted into carbonic acid. That's the majority way we carry carbon dioxide. And then the carbon dioxide is reconverted The carbon dioxide becomes carbonic acid, and the carbonic acid is reinverted back into carbon dioxide when it gets to the lungs, which you then blow it off. So blood flows through the systemic capillaries, we lose the oxygen and pick up the CO2, and then once it's in there, the CO2 combines with water to form carbonic acid. We'll get into that whole process a bit later. As CO2 is entering the red blood cells, the hemoglobin is giving up its oxygen to give it to the tissues. And this deoxygenated red blood cell then pick up most of the hydrogen, which is wrong. I'm reading that now, it's like I didn't realize that statement was there. When a red blood cell travels through a capillary and gets to tissues to give up oxygen, it only lives one or two. So the average red blood cell, a hemoglobin molecule, only carries 4 oxygen molecules. And there are a number of them in a red blood cell, but only not 100% of the oxygen in a red blood cell actually leaves a red blood cell. You have lots of extra that's traveling around your body you don't even use half the time. So there is some connection with hemoglobin and carbon dioxide, but that is not the most common way that carbon dioxide flows through the blood. But don't worry, we'll get to that when we talk about the blood system a little bit later on. Okay? Just understand that the protein is buffering the hydrogen. So the carbonic acid bicarbonate buffer system. So first we had to create the carbonic acid. Okay? Now, the carbonic acid bicarbonate buffer system, bicarbonate, we talked about sodium bicarbonate with cooking and making a base. Okay, bicarbonate is a weak base, and the carbonic acid is a weak acid. As part of the previous dissociation, HCO3 was created. So when we had the dissociation here, when it gave up a hydrogen, it then created HCO3. If there's excess hydrogen, the bicarbonate can act as a weak base and therefore remove the excess H from the solution. So H is created when carbon dioxide gets in back into the blood. The question becomes, how much oxygen is there or isn't there? So we either can say there's enough in there, everything's fine, or we can use the bicarbonate that's in here to make the blood a little more alkaline by removing the hydrogen that was created. If there is a shortage of hydrogen, the carbonic acid can act as a weak acid and contribute the needed hydrogen to the solution. So what we're saying here is, again, from a homeostatic perspective, things are always shifting. Is there too much hydrogen in the blood or is there not enough? If there's too much, we've got bicarbonate here to remove hydrogen. If there's not enough, we have carbonic acid here to give hydrogen to maintain the appropriate pH of blood as it's traveling through the body. And again, you need that appropriate pH so that the chemical and biological processes that occur within the bloodstream can occur optimally by maintaining the sweet spot. Okay? Increase in CO2 in body fluids increases hydrogen concentration, thus lowering pH. So when we have increase in CO2, you increase hydrogen. Of course, increased hydrogen equals acidity, right? Carbonic acid can be eliminated by exhaling CO2, and a decrease in CO2 concentration raises the pH, making things more alkaline. So the fact that we're able to breathe off carbon dioxide helps maintain the appropriate pH values. If we can't breathe off carbon dioxide, then hydrogen is going to build up and things are going to get more acidic. Yes.
Yep.
The carbonic acid gets changed as it crosses into the lung tissue.
Okay.
And we'll get into that when we do respiratory physiology in the second half.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. So the rate and depth of breathing can alter the pH of body fluids within a couple of minutes. Why do you breathe harder and faster when you're exercising? Yes, you breathe harder and faster to maintain the appropriate acidic levels by blowing off CO2. You don't breathe harder and faster because you need more oxygen. I have no idea. I don't hold my breath anymore. I couldn't tell you. So, you alter the pH by breathing. When CO2 levels decrease, hydrogen concentration increases, and blood pH decreases when you're doing this. Reducing breathing to 1/4 of normal lowers the pH from 7.4 normal to 7.0 terminal. That's how narrow this parameter is. When you can't breathe, you're going to start to build up carbon dioxide, and your pH will go from 7.4 to 7.0, and if they don't do something right away, you will die. Yes.
Why is it carbon dioxide specifically and not other, like, external?
Well, there are other gases that go in, so they can maintain what's called they hyperinflate. So because they can't breathe out, they just keep breathing in, because like a balloon, they get hyperinflated, right? So the worst thing you can give, what's the worst thing you can give a COPD person when they come into eMERGE? Interesting. So they say that they can give them pure oxygen when they come in if they're suffering. Wow, that's changed.
5% of
our retainers?
Yeah.
Oh, show me where that is, because I worked in cardiorespiratory, and that was always. I had no idea. I looked that up. When body blood acidity increases, the decrease in pH is detected by central chemoreceptors in the medulla and peripheral chemoreceptors in the aorta and carotid bodies. So there are these receptors sit within the bloodstream itself, and they're actually measuring percent hydrogen. Both of these stimulate the respiratory group in the medulla. So if there's too much hydrogen, you start breathing faster to blow off the CO2. This results in an increase in both the forcefulness and the depth of breathing. Now, kidney excretion of hydrogen is another mechanism to affect pH changes. Metabolic reactions produce a non-volatile acid. Well, like there's always acids that are being produced through metabolic processes within tissues and cells. So therefore, we produce a large acid load on the body, and it's the kidney's role to help excrete hydrogen into the urine. No, I've never tasted urine, so I don't know if it tastes acidic or not. I don't know. I know if you put a litmus paper in it, it will certainly change color. So therefore, if the kidneys fail, you will too if they don't deal with it quite quickly. You'll get global acidosis, and you'll be maybe pushing up daisies fairly quickly. I'm not worried about the group work because we already kind of did that. Good. Okay. Did I get through that stack pretty good? There you are. Yeah. All right. So, we've left chemistry. Now we're going to get into the cell. And this should be reviewed for many of you. You've all done cell at some point, correct? Am I missing a whole section?
No, I might have had it.
Okay, you scared me there. I'm like, this is a whole... Okay, the human cell. The human cell contains the basic components to sustain life. Cells are alive. They have functions. They reproduce, they breathe, they eat, they drink, they secrete, all sorts of things. So they're the basic component to sustain life. There are four main parts to any cell. The first is its membrane. So the cell membrane is the outer portion of the cell itself, and not unlike your skin on your body, the cell membrane controls what goes into the cell and what can come out of the cell. It's very good at that. It plays a major role in that. Next is the cytosol. So there is a fluid within the membranous capsule, if you want to call it that. It is a semi-fluid found between the membrane and the nucleus. We find water, proteins, carbohydrates, ions, lipids, vitamins, minerals, and gases in this cytosol. As a term, cytoplasm includes everything between the cell membrane and the nucleus, which includes the cytosol, inclusions, and organelles. So cytosol is the fluid between the membrane and the nucleus, and the cytoplasm is everything between the membrane and the nucleus. No. Yes, interstitial fluid is a fluid that lies between the cells outside them.
Oh, right.
Okay. Organelles, just think of them as little organs, just like you have. You have a heart, lungs, stomach, all that kind of stuff. These organelles are little functioning organs within the cell. So they're specialized. They have each of them has very specific roles within the normal functioning of any kind of cell in the body. And, you know, depending on, again, structure governs function, depending on what the cell does, you might find many of one kind and not so many of another. The thing to always remember in drawings in anatomy textbooks, the artists, for the purposes of learning, just draw one of everything in a cell so you can kind of see that it's in there. The reality is, you know, for example, muscle cells, right, will have anywhere upwards of 100 to 150 mitochondria in, creating massive amounts of ATP, whereas other cells don't have that quite that many. So it's all, again, structure governs function. Inclusions are temporary structures. They are there, and then they disappear and come back. So sometimes it could be a cell that's producing a compound that needs to be secreted out of it, so it's there for a while, and then it disappears. So inclusions can be there or not there. So again, you look here. There's everything a cell could possibly have is in this drawing. Books are all the same, but not necessarily every cell has everything. But that's, you know, just kind of giving you the overall part. Yes. Yes. It could be sweat that's being produced by a sudoriferous gland. It could be a number of different things. So the membrane. Now, the membrane is said to be semi-permeable. This is weird having chalk. I haven't had chalk in forever. So semi-permeable means what? Okay. Right. And some things can get, some things can't. So semi-permeable, and there are three compounds that make up the membrane. So this membrane, when we look at it, has a very interesting configuration. Proteins make up approximately 50% of membrane by mass. Remember I said everything is about proteins, okay? You're going to hear proteins a lot now from here on in. So proteins make up about 50% of the membrane by mass. Two of the types are called integral. One's called integral, one's called peripheral. So I'm going to draw membrane here for a second. And this may be something that all of you suddenly remember and go, oh God, I remember that. Remember it now? Some of you? Okay, so that's the cell membrane. We'll get into those components later. Let's talk about the proteins first. So the first is called an integral protein. It's an important protein because it allows substances to travel into or out of the cell. So it's a protein that kind of looks like this. Okay, it's tubular in nature. We're going to say this is outside the cell, and we're going to say this is inside. Okay? So this integral protein is a protein that sits and has exposure both outside the cell and to the inside of the cell. So this is a solid protein. So this is your integral protein. Okay? The other one is called a peripheral. Now, a peripheral protein is slightly different. It kind of sits either here or here. So it sits on the periphery of the membrane itself one way or the other. And they each have their own roles when we look at them individually. Eventually here. There it is. So we can see that one goes through, one sits on top. The next are lipids. Lipids are fat. Okay? So there are three types of lipids seen in the membrane. There are phospholipids, glycolipids, and cholesterol. The lipids form 45% of the membrane. So in other words, the cell membrane is made up considerably of fat, okay, or lipids. So phospholipids, glycolipids, and cholesterol. The third component that we can find are carbohydrates, and carbohydrates are fundamentally sugars, okay? These are usually found attached to the integral proteins and lipids, and they account for the rest of the cell membrane by mass. And what happens is a sugar attaches to either a protein or a lipid, and these can act as receptors. So these are how there's recognition. It's how cells kind of interact with each other, are these sugar receptors. So we can see here, here is an integral protein that we can see here. Here are your peripheral proteins, a little bit that we can see around. But we can see these branched chain carbohydrates, these sugars coming off. So if it's attached to one of the proteins, it's a glycoprotein. If it's attached to one of the fat lipid components of the cell membrane, it is known as a glycolipid. Okay? So far, so good. We're just looking at the membrane right now, this membrane of a cell. The membrane of a cell. So although the proteins are a greater portion of the membrane by mass, remember, approximately 50%, it's the lipids that take the greater area of the membrane since they're not as heavy as proteins. So in your mind right now, what I'd like you to do, and you've seen kids use them at the park, you know the great big bubbles kids make with the rope, the stick and the rope, and they make that great big huge bubble that floats through the air in the park? Have you ever looked at that? You've never seen one? The soap bubbles. The kids have a big string on a stick, and they dip it in, and then the air blows. You know what I mean? No? Okay. So you look at that big bubble, and the sun's shining on it. What's it look like? It looks like a rainbow. Is it moving? Right. It's moving and shifting. That's exactly what a cell membrane looks like. Think of that soap bubble. Okay? Very thin. And you know it's shifting because there's soap and water, right? So you can see the water sliding around the soap when it's floating through the air. What we're saying here is that there's proteins within the soap bubble, and they're heavier than the soap bubble, so therefore they represent a certain percentage. But fundamentally, the fats, which make up the whole bubble, have a far greater surface area than the proteins do. Make sense, though? Okay, so the lipid portions are said to be amphipathic, which means they have a polar head and a nonpolar head. Huh? So, the polar part is the head, and it is hydrophilic. What's that mean? Okay? It does not like water. Hydrophilic likes water. Whereas the nonpolar part, the tails, are hydrophobic. So, this area here is hydrophilic, and this area here is hydrophobic. Okay? So you can see we've got a head in white and a bunch of tails, correct? See the two tails coming off of each one? So this area here is okay with water. And this area here is not okay with water. So far, so good. The tails are fatty acids. So we could just use FA. Tails are fatty acid, right? And then the head is for crying out loud. My brain's not working. What's the head made of? I can't remember. Lost me. For our purposes, it doesn't matter. That's why it's gone. There are two layers of lipids that make up the membrane. Would that be correct? There's two layers of lipids. If the fatty acids are lipids, is there two layers there? Yes, right? There's one layer that comes off of this one and another layer that comes off of this one. So we say it's double. So there are two layers of lipids that make up the membrane all the way along. The hydrophilic portions face the intracellular and extracellular areas. So again, the hydrophilic areas, all the circles here facing the outside of the cell and here facing the inside of the cell. So that's the water-loving part. The hydrophobic face is in the middle of the lipid bilayer. So because there's two of them, right, layer here, we call this a lipid bilayer. So because there are two layers of lipid tails, its actual name is called a lipid bilayer. So there are two layers of lipids made up by the tails, which are the fatty acids. What about it? No, it's about cholesterol. Phosphorus. Phosphate. That's it. I said phosphorus, phosphate. Thank you. All right? Therefore, the cell membrane is known as the lipid bilayer membrane. Now, cholesterol has a hydrophilic portion, which helps create the hydrophilic portion of the membrane. What's interesting about cholesterol, it's firm. It's hard. Have you ever noticed people who got the yellow, anybody here got grandparents, and you can see that yellow deposit around their eyes, it looks really hard? That's actually cholesterol. It means it's not a good thing if you start seeing cholesterol showing up around the eyes. But that's actually cholesterol. So we're going to put a bit of cholesterol here, because cholesterol has a really cool role. Because it's firm, it provides some structure to the cell. Right? So you might find it anywhere. Deliberately make it yellow. Again, because it's firm, it helps provide some structure to the membrane. So we say cholesterol has a hydrophilic portion, which helps create the hydrophilic portion of the membrane. It's more rigid than the phospholipid and therefore provides rigidity and strength to the overall membrane, which helps make it stronger. Now, the glycolipids are also amphipathic, which means they have polar and nonpolar segments, and they also help create the hydrophilic and hydrophobic segments. So I have to understand that this is all being made either hydrophobic or hydrophilic, depending on it. The carbohydrates, so remember glycolipids, I have a really hard time drawing five sides to make a sugar. I'll try here. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Whatever it may be. These are sugars that are attached here, so therefore they're providing some to it. So they kind of stick out the top. So you can kind of see them here. See how the carbohydrates are sticking either off the proteins, which makes a glycoprotein, or I believe it was this one here. You can see a glycolipid here. It's the sugar molecule is actually attached to the membrane itself and not to one of the proteins, so therefore it's a glycolipid because it's the membrane, not one of the integral proteins. The carbohydrate portions of the glycolipids and glycoproteins, so remember the sugars that are either attached to lipids or proteins, forms a coating on the cell, and that coating is just like an M&M's. So think of, you've got a sugar coating, whether it's peanut or chocolate or Smarties. So these sugars that are attached to these lipids and proteins form a coating on a cell called the glycocalyx. Okay? Helps form the glycocalyx. The pattern of carbohydrates varies from cell to cell. Therefore, it's a type of molecular signature. Invaders have their own type of glycocalyx, and it's their glycocalyx that our immune system goes, what are you doing here? You don't belong here. The alarms go off, right? It's time to deal with whatever's in the body, because all cells know each other. At one point in mom, you self-identify so that the markers that are on your cells are recognizable by your immune system, so they can go flow by and go, oh yeah, you belong here, yeah, you belong here, you don't, what are you doing here? And then you have an immune response because it's an invader that's been identified. And there's many ways to do that, but ultimately cells have their own sort of glycocalyxes and so forth, so this is how they're recognizable within it. But it's also how the body recognizes itself. So we say invaders have a specific glycocalyx, therefore we get an immune response. The glycocalyx also helps hold the cells together, and it does help protect the membrane from some enzymes, because some viruses produce enzymes to try to dissolve through the cell membrane to take over said cell and destroy it. Okay? It also creates what's called a negative charge on the cell surface, which tends to attract cations and repel anions. Many viruses and bacteria actually have ions on them, so there's a they don't like each other, so they'll tend not to stick as well. It's kind of another form of defense the cell has. So these integral proteins, they pass the entire width of the membrane, as you can see here. They have a couple of functions. because they can be a channel. So you can see, because it's tubular all the way through, as a channel, they sort of represent a pore or hole that is responsible to allow specific ions to pass through one way or the other, depending on what's going on. Now, you have a channel for each thing. So there is a sodium pump, which is an integral protein that's responsible for sodium. We have one responsible for calcium. We have one responsible for potassium and so forth. Okay, so they allow things to move over and back. Some of them are carriers. Now, sometimes, remember, this part of the cell membrane likes water. This part of the cell doesn't like water. If you have a very large water-soluble compound, it cannot get through that membrane. Or cannot get through that membrane very, very easily. It has to really work at it. Okay? So a water-soluble compound, which represents an amino acid, for example, or a glucose molecule, it cannot get through that membrane very well because it's water-soluble. So we have to have special transporters that carry that large compound, such as glucose, carries it into the cell, kind of like a backpack. It's kind of walking through and getting to the other side of the cell. Okay? Now, there can be, they also can act as receptors because they're exposed. These are cellular recognition sites. Specific receptors bind to a specific type of molecule. For example, on some of these integral proteins, they have a receptor that is sensitive to insulin. So when insulin is released in the blood, it attaches onto this integral protein, which then stimulates that integral protein to grab glucose and bring it into the cell, thus removing it from the blood system, maintaining the appropriate amount of glucose in the system. They have an entirely different role. I'm only talking about integrals right now. Okay? So when we have a specific integral protein that is sensitive to a very specific type of compound, we say that in the case of insulin, you have a type of molecule, insulin receptor, and insulin becomes what is called the ligand. So there are ligand receptors on certain integral proteins that are sensitive to whatever compound gets released, again, such as insulin that's forcing glucose in. Because, again, glucose is a very large water-soluble compound. It can't get through the membrane very well. So this is why we need to have these proteins, integral proteins, that allow glucose to get into the cell very, very quickly. And, of course, proteins. Everything's about proteins. Proteins are enzymes, and they are vital to our physiology. What do enzymes do? Kind of, yeah. Great. Yeah, okay.
They catalyze
the chemical reactions. What do they do to chemical reactions? Yes. Without enzymes, to do something simple would take a half an hour. We sometimes don't have half an hour. Enzymes significantly speed up chemical processes. So the body uses many enzymes to speed up normal processes that would take time to happen much, much quicker. Okay? So we can see here, it says that membrane proteins include ion channels, which allow specific ions to move through this membrane. We've got carriers. You can see it actually carries the compound across the membrane by changing shape. And then we have these ligands, which, again, they're a receptor that are sensitive to some chemical, which causes them to alter shape to allow compounds through or out. Enzymes, of course, catalyze reactions inside or outside the cell, speeding them up and making them better. We do have linkers, which I don't get into much, but they just provide stability to the membrane. And then another thing that these integral proteins do are cell identity markers. So it distinguishes your cells from anyone else's unless you're an identical twin. It is this cell identity marker the reason why I can't just take my heart out and give it to you. Because the moment my heart goes in you, your whole immune system goes, your cell marker is, we don't know you. You get out of here. And the immune system actually will attack the heart and kill it if it can, because it doesn't believe it belongs there. So one of the things we do with people who've had organ transplants is we put them on medication that significantly lowers the immune response.
We also, you know, do things like, you know, they look at your blood to see how close your stuff is compared to them, and it, you know, closer a match, the better, you know, the immune system isn't going to react to it as far as that goes. But even today, people still get organs, and they just don't go well. There's a reaction and a response to it, and the organ fails, and unfortunately, the transplant doesn't work. It still does happen. So, but yeah, so that's where, and the other part of it is within the cell identity marker, you've probably all heard of autoimmune disorders. So that's one day the immune system looks at your cell and goes, hey, yeah, you blowing arrows are going, Joe. And the next day, there's changes in whatever happened. Even though I knew Joe yesterday, I'm going to kill Joe today. So things like rheumatoid arthritis, cystic fibrosis, there's quite a number of diseases now that are getting related to autoimmune disorders where the immune system basically turns in on itself and destroys your tissues, even though it shouldn't. Okay, all right, that's it. You're done. Did anybody have any problems with the recordings? They're working fine, no problems. Yeah, but remember what happened?